Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. A bit subdued at the moment, but it won't be that way forever. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. So how you doing? How are you coping? Going a little stir-crazy, I'd imagine. Well, tonight we'll embark on a mental, emotional, psychic journey into unspecified realms inhabited by unknown beings. We'll get out of the house, pop over to Magonia maybe, Shangri-La, Brigadoon, take the brain out for a spin, hit the road, and floor it. You know, the assorted strange phenomena we often discuss on this program. You know the list. UFOs and ETs and crypto creatures, poltergeist, ghosts, crop circles, and all the rest. We're always in search of a unified theory of weirdness here, wondering how or if all of these things might fit together. And we really don't know. It often seems like it's about journey, you know, not the destination. Trying to figure out about this stuff teaches us plenty about ourselves and the world around us. In spite of a reluctance by segments of our society that don't really want to acknowledge any of this or to ask questions, they certainly don't want us to talk about it, and they scoff at those of us who do. They don't want to study it either. We have two guests tonight who will share with us their own viewpoints, hard-earned in both cases. Dr. Alexander Wendt is a distinguished academic. He's taught at Yale and Dartmouth, the University of Chicago, and currently is at The Ohio State University. He's a recognized authority on international relations, a political scientist who, for some crazy reason, started looking at the UFO question from a political science viewpoint well over a decade ago, maybe longer. And he's repeatedly made the argument that the UFO topic is something we should be studying, but we're not. That it is essentially a taboo. Earlier this year, he delivered a TED Talk. That's the prestigious platform for deep thinkers. You've probably seen it on YouTube. And he made his case about why UFOs should be studied and why they aren't the great taboo, as if to prove the point that he was making for the TED Talk folks. They flagged his presentation for straying outside the boundaries of what's acceptable. Irony, thy name is TED. You know, it takes guts for an academic at a major university to discuss this topic anywhere, let alone on such a huge platform. We've wanted to get him here for a while now, and Alex joins me momentarily to share his take on the social pressures that are at play with this subject. In the second half tonight, we're going to broaden the scope a bit. A decade and a half ago, when my friend Colm Kelleher and I were grappling with a set of perplexing mysteries surrounding a paranormal hotspot, we're trying to make sense of why so many different phenomena would pop up in the same general area year after year and decade after decade, but never in quite the same way. And we found this book, Daemonic Reality by Patrick Harper, who looked at otherworldly phenomena through a different prism, through a different lens, tying them together sort of with philosophical, historical, and very human points of view, experiences that people have been reporting all over the world throughout human history, on every continent, in every culture, in different forms and guises, but which were all connected at a much deeper level. And that understanding that we used to have, it was once global, it was innate, but it was kind of pounded out of us once we became more, and I'm using air quotes here, more advanced and more educated and more civilized. And I wanted to get Patrick on the program for a long time. Tonight it happens. It really does kind of change the way one looks at the world after you read this book. That's coming up in the second half. I don't want to dwell on the news too much. You've likely been watching and reading at home much more than you really wanted to. You know, the U.S. is headed toward a million cases of the virus at this point. It's like 965,000 at last count and just under 55,000 deaths in the U.S. As the economy is still on pause and people are wondering when they can go back to work, you know, we all got a little time on our hands to evaluate where things stand, how the earth is doing. Webmaster Greg Bishop and I have pulled together our usual assortment of news items and oddities. We call it Knapp's News, and you can find it on the Coast to Coast website. One of the stories featured there tonight is about the worst ecological disaster in U.S. history. You probably haven't thought about it in a while, sort of like it either never happened, or it's old news, or it's all gone away. Deepwater Horizon, remember that? The terrible oil spill that poisoned a huge swath of the Gulf. That mess never really went away. The effects are still being felt, and it's probably going to be that way for a long, long time. We got an update for you. Also, a couple of think pieces related to subjects that we often discuss here, a new view of life in the universe, trying to calculate how likely it is to find it out there. Also, a theoretical framework that suggests that space and time do not really exist, and another piece about why we believe what we believe. Those stories and a lot more in NAPS News, a little UFO news in there as well. While you're on the website, check out how to become a Coast Insider. If you subscribe for a year, the cost is pennies a day. I think it's 15 cents. Gives you access to a huge archive of programs, including the Art Bell Classics. You can listen anytime you want, as often as you want, on multiple different devices. You can likewise subscribe to George Norrie's television program, Beyond Belief, which covers a lot of ground similar to what George does on the radio show here. With that, let's assume the position, bring in the dog and the cat and the chicken and the chuckwalla, put on a pot of Joe, slide your bod into those silky jammies and the bunny slippers, plop yourself down in a comfy spot, turn down the lights and turn up the radio, because we're about ready to in a moment. Dr. Alexander Wendt, Academic Freedom and the UFO Mystery. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. You know, UFOs have been such a persistent part of modern culture all over the world, but especially in the media-saturated United States with movies and TV and books and news coverage, 70 years of it, 70 plus years. And yet one would think that, you know, by now it would be acceptable for scientists to admit what many of them have, secretly have, a quiet but serious interest in UFOs. I mean, who doesn't? Of course, people of science, learned people, people with active minds would be interested in the subject. But, you know, for scientists and academics, it's like touching the third rail sometimes. Remember Harvard's Dr. John Mack, brilliant guy who had the courage to investigate these strange encounters? Harvard tried to go after his tenure. And even now, it is simply safer for academics to keep their interests in these kind of topics to themselves. Dr. Alexander Wendt didn't do that, though. He's been writing about UFOs for 12 years that I know of, and earlier this year, he gave a TED Talk presentation, about 13 minutes, a position on why UFOs deserve to be taken seriously by science, didn't endorse the idea that they're ETs, didn't claim to have been abducted, just said, hey, you know what, we should be free of the taboo that prevents serious study. Well, you can guess how that went over. Dr. Wendt, Alex, welcome to the program. Wanted to have you here for a while. I'm so glad you were able to join us.
Oh, thank you, George. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, I read your paper that came out in 2008, and we'll get into that in a moment. And I saw your TED Talks presentation earlier this year, and we'll also jump into that. But I had not read your personal webpage until I was preparing for this conversation. And on that site, as you say, you write that you have a little more freedom to express personal interest there. I got the hint that maybe you've been interested in topics of this nature for a long time. Where, how far back does it go?
Well, on UFOs in particular, I've been interested since April 99. I had an epiphany that month, and ever since then, I've been kind of very gung-ho on this topic.
An epiphany or a sighting?
An epiphany. I've never had a sighting.
So tell me what the epiphany was. How did that work?
Well, I realized that I was ignorant. It was an epiphany of ignorance. Even though UFOs are unidentified, I think modern science assumes that we somehow know that these things either don't exist or we know that they're not ETs. And I realized that we actually don't know that because no one has ever done the science. And so actually, we're completely ignorant about what these phenomena are. And then that raised a lot of questions for me as a political scientist, which would then set me down the path.
The paper in 2008. So am I exaggerating the courage that it takes for somebody in your line of work to go ahead and go out on that limb?
Well, I don't know. It certainly did not help me professionally, but I think most of my colleagues just kind of just closed their eyes and tolerated it. And so I haven't received too much flack for it, but the paper has received almost no attention either. So I think the field just kind of pretended it didn't happen, and that was their way of dealing with it.
Can you share with us the central thesis of that paper? I mean, that's where you first introduced, as far as I know, the idea of the great taboo.
Yeah, the purpose of the paper was really to kind of make sense of what I think is a puzzle, which is that, you know, we have these phenomena out there. If they were ETs, and we discovered that, it would be one of the most important events in human history. And yet scientists are not allowed to study this. The whole topic is ridiculed and so on. So we were interested, my co-author and I were interested in why there is this taboo. And we made the argument that the modern governments, the modern state, depends on human beings, their citizens, basically believing that the only power on earth, the only sovereignty on earth is human. The gods are not here anymore. Nature is no longer sovereign. It's humans that are sovereign. And governments, their job is to protect us, and our job is to obey the rules. And the UFO, if the UFO could be ET, fundamentally threatens that social contract, because UFOs, if they are ETs, would have vastly more power than human beings do. And in a sense, the risk is that by posing the question, what are UFOs, the government would be, in effect, laying the seeds for its own demise, potentially. So they really can't even ask the question. They have to just turn their heads away from it. It's kind of the short answer, I guess, although it was kind of long.
So of course, I've chased that same question sort of from a journalism standpoint, not a political science standpoint, trying to figure out if there is a cover-up, and there is some evidence that that is the case, why it would exist, why the government wouldn't want to come clean. And, you know, sort of the answer is, you know, it's a mixture of things with the national security implications. If they know something, they don't want other governments or rival governments to know. And then the idea that coming forward to explain, we don't know who they are, where they're from, why they're here, but they can do all kinds of things that we can't do. It really puts the government in an awkward spot. The idea that we are not the top of the food chain, you know, we're not the top of the evolutionary ladder. I don't know that any government wants to admit that.
Absolutely. There's no upside, I think, for governments on this, and there's only downsides. So I totally agree that the real issue is, what are they covering up? And that's where you can get disagreements. And personally, I think they're covering up their own ignorance. But many times the argument is, well, they're covering up actual contact with aliens and that kind of thing. And that's a further step, which I haven't taken, but at the very least, they're covering up the fact that we have no idea what these things are.
So the 2008 paper comes out. Is there any blowback at all?
No, actually, the paper sank like a stone compared to actually to my other work, which is much less interesting. That paper has never been a published rebuttal or rejoinder to it from anybody, as far as I know. On the other hand, we were told by the editors of the journal that it was published in a few years ago that it was by far the most downloaded paper in that journal's history. So somebody is reading it and downloading it, but nobody is responding to it in print. So it's an interesting pattern, I think.
I'll tell you what, I've got a link to it. I'm going to send it to our webmaster, Greg, and we'll post it so our listeners can read it as well. So then you dip your toes back into these waters earlier this year. I think in part because of the revelations that came out December 2017, New York Times comes out with this blockbuster story. Those videos are released. Suddenly you have some ammo to include in a presentation. How is it that you you were able to get this TED Talks platform happening?
Well, it was actually kind of random. I mean, I'd been interested in the New York Times story, certainly piqued my interest, and I was interested in looking for an opportunity to kind of put some ideas out there. A few months earlier, I had been contacted out of the blue by Ancient Aliens, the people there, to appear on their show. And I was told that, well, I've never been on TV before, so I should get a media trainer. And so I got a media trainer here in Columbus. And when I told the media trainer the argument I wanted to make about UFOs, she was blown away and said, you've got to do this as a TEDx talk, because it turns out she was one of the organizers for TEDx in Columbus. And so she convinced me to apply for the TEDx slot, and I got it. Apparently it wasn't easy necessarily. It almost didn't go through, but it did go through. And so it was really kind of a random chance event, and really Megan, my trainer, who put the idea in my head to do it right then.
Was there resistance that you know of once they figured out what your topic was?
Apparently there was inside the local TEDx, the committee that approved my talk locally. There was apparently some debate, and Megan had to make a case. So she's really responsible for getting me past the censors, so to speak.
I've watched it a couple of times. I mean, there's nothing there. It's eminently reasonable. It's you know, you're not making any outrageous statements. You do say at the beginning, hey, you let the audience know, I'm a serious guy. I have a serious reputation in my field. I'm often cited, political science, international relations, and I have no intention of squandering that today. And they all kind of, there's a little chuckle there. You had to know there was at least some risk, though, right?
Oh, yeah. No, that's certainly right. But, you know, I think at this stage of my career, I can't really do too much damage to myself. And so if I'm going to do it, I may as well do it now. Sort of was my thing, has been my thinking anyway.
So give me sort of a thumbnail of the taboo argument, what you have said in the presentation and what the basis for that is.
Well, I just first called attention to the fact that no scientific community has ever systematically studied this phenomenon. And when you think about it, that's kind of puzzling. I tried to set up the puzzle because if we did find out that these things were ETs, that would be obviously hugely important. But I took no position on whether they were ETs or not. But what I did do is it's very, very important in this topic, as I'm sure your listeners know, to separate UFOs from ETs. And in the modern scientific community, people just assume they're the same thing. And so if you can dismiss ETs, then you can dismiss UFOs. And so I tried to separate them, and then I used the Navy videos to show or to try to argue that UFOs, at least, are real. And the videos are quite compelling, and they kind of make the case for themselves. And then I posed the question, what if they're ETs? And that's where I then went off from there.
You also make the argument, look, humans are curious by nature. We study everything.
Yeah.
Well, how could we not study this?
Yeah, now that's one of the big puzzles, I think, about this whole topic is that you would think that especially after the Navy has now said, hey, these things are real, whatever they are, they're real, you'd think the scientists would be pouring in so they can get famous, be the first ones to figure out what these bizarre phenomena are. But in fact, there is, as far as I can tell, there's no reaction from the scientific community to the Navy's videos or the Navy's policy change. I think that's very, very striking. And to me, it illustrates the taboo nature of this topic. It's an issue that just makes scientists really, really nervous, and even more so apparently than the government, which through the Navy is beginning to, in a way, at least indirectly, come to grips with it.
Can you discuss from a political science standpoint, what might happen if it was confirmed it's ET? I mean, I've used that line myself that it would be one of the biggest or the biggest discovery in history. It would change everything. From a political science standpoint, analyzing how governments would react if it's confirmed in a way that's beyond their control, what do you think would happen?
Well, that's a big question. I think in a way, we're in kind of a, if in fact, and of course we have no way of knowing this right now, but if in fact some UFOs are ETs, then we're really right now in kind of a pre-contact situation, the way the indigenous people in the Americas were before Columbus came, in a sense. And I think that, you know, I've thought about the consequences of contact a little bit, not as much as a few other people. But I do think that there are a lot of risks involved. I think there's a risk of a collapse of state authority because citizens might realize that states can't protect us from these creatures. So that would be one thing because of the power asymmetry. I worry about, you know, people, even if the government says everything is fine and we'll deal with this, that individuals may go crazy. Survivalists will, you know, quickly do their thing. So I think that you might have a lot of fragmentation in the human population about what should be done. And one could imagine potentially violent resistance by some people in society to this kind of news. So I think there's a lot of potential for collapse in society or violence. I don't see a lot of upsides unless the ETs, if they're here, help us along and help us figure it out.
Alex Wentz, we'll come back to that and continue down the road of where it could lead if some kind of a discovery like that were confirmed. I think the virus, what's happened with the virus, how quickly our world has changed, how quickly our understanding of the world and reality has changed just in the blink of an eye, turned things upside down for all of us. And I wonder if there's a lesson in that for how it applies to the discussion we're having now, the reality of UFOs being confirmed either by a government or by some kind of an event where the reality of it being from somewhere else is undeniable, how it would change us. And it might happen in ways that we couldn't even predict. We're going to continue that conversation with my guest, Dr. Alexander Wendt, right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Wendt, I wanted to return to sort of the general question of what could happen. Say there's a landing on the White House lawn or some kind of a demonstration that is really hard to deny, or something on a global scale, some announcement from space, or a government official coming forward to say, yeah, it's real. They're here. We don't exactly know where they're from. All the different ways that that could play out. And I wonder if you have thought about it in the context of what we're going through right now with the virus, all the discontent that's bubbling just below the surface and different people reacting in different ways. And, you know, kind of a general, we've been pretty calm in some ways, but it feels like we're approaching a breaking point.
Yeah, no, the COVID comparison is an interesting one, I think. And I think that COVID, on the one hand, seems to show that human beings can unite pretty easily, even if there are people who are unhappy with particular rules or regulations and so on. There has been a powerful unifying force that's transcended governments worldwide. I'm not sure that you would get, and that unification has kind of helped keep everybody on board and is helping us deal with the virus. I'm not sure that governments will be able to have that kind of unity, especially with their people, if we have a contact scenario with ETs. But at the same time, I really doubt, personally, I'm very skeptical that there would be any moment where there would be a sudden revelation, either by the government or the ETs themselves. My guess is that if ETs are here, the discovery process will be actually a very slow process of kind of getting us used to the fact. And then when it finally becomes clear, it'll be much less traumatic. But that's, of course, entirely speculation. But
So the rules that would apply to the U.S. government, the paper that you have written about how our government, you know, the great taboo, the unlikelihood that there would be an announcement of any kind of that them coming forward and admitting what we all suspect. That would apply to other governments as well, China, Russia, because that's one of the scenarios that's described in UFO studies. Hey, what if one of our adversaries decides to spill the beans?
Yes, and I think actually if there are ETs here, they could care less about our petty governmental squabbles, and they probably would treat all human beings as if we were the same. And other governments, I think, in terms of spilling the beans, they have no more incentive to do that than our government does. Because the bottom line is that human beings have virtually no control over this phenomenon. So if there were to be a contact situation, we would be totally basically at the mercy of whoever it is we're dealing with on the other side. But that's very hard, I think, for governments and human beings to admit. We're used to being in charge. We're used to being sovereign over the planet. And the idea that we're essentially powerless, I think, is a very frightening one, and that may help explain the taboo in part anyway.
NASA Brookings Institute study 1960, which looked at that question and analyzed what would happen if, and that study, I'm sure you probably read it, basically social institutions would collapse.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I think there's a real risk of that. But presumably any ETs, if they're here, they know this. They've probably done this 100 times. And they know exactly what the consequences would be. And that may be one reason why they don't land on the White House lawn, because it would be so destructive.
Religions, you know, you look at religions. I know when I started this 30 some years ago, I wanted to sort of do my own little poll about religious leaders. So I'd asked a couple of different ones of different faiths, how they would handle it. And at least the Las Vegas representatives for these different faiths, a Baptist, a Catholic, and a LDS, Mormon, they were all kind of open to the idea. They expressed the idea they could handle it, that in essence, it would just be more souls to save. The LDS, the Mormons, were in particular very comfortable with the idea of other worlds out there and other peoples. But, you know, that's a one-on-one conversation, me talking to them and them putting a pretty positive spin on it. I'm not sure about the churches as institutions would react the same way. I kind of doubt it.
Yeah, I would be surprised, too. There have been, I haven't followed this closely, but I know there have been interesting debates among theologians about extraterrestrial life and so on. Usually that's in a more abstract context where they're far away and not up close, which I think would change the dynamic completely. But, you know, whether religions, I think the idea that human religions can easily accommodate this, an up close contact, I guess I'm skeptical in part because it assumes that, again, we have some kind of control and that we have some power in this scenario. And I'm thinking, in fact, if there's a contact, we will be essentially powerless, and we'll just have to hope that the intentions of our visitors are benign.
Back to your TEDx talk, you make the argument and the observation in this presentation that, you know, we're spending large chunks of money on these these telescopes, space telescopes that go out there to look at faraway stars in sort of the belief that we might spot an ancient or alien civilization out there, when we have absolutely no proof whatsoever that that approach would work. And yet a mystery much closer to home here on the ground, the science is unwilling to take it on. I guess it's one thing to look far, far away as something that is not quite as threatening because it's way, way out there, than it is to take a look at something right here on the ground.
Absolutely. No, I think that the attitude of the SETI community toward ufology has always been a source of puzzlement. I think that's really a symptom of that there is something taboo here and something deeply political, because the fact that the very people who have spent all this money looking for alien life elsewhere are adamant about not looking close by, I think it's just irrational, it seems to me, and testifies to the power and depth, I think, of this belief that, well, it's okay to think about ETs, but up close, that's a totally different scenario. And again, it's the power asymmetry. That's what's so scary about it, I think.
You made great use in your presentation of the new information that surfaced with that New York Times story, the videos that came out, and subsequent statements from the Navy in which they changed their policy to make it easier for pilots to go ahead and report this. Now, I was not surprised by the videos, surprised that they got out, I guess, but not surprised that they existed, not surprised that there was a study, but I was really surprised by the Navy's reaction to it and issuing a statement that was a message to their pilots, hey, we want to collect information. That seemed a very profound change to me. I think you had the same reaction.
Yeah, it is a big change, and in a way it runs against the theory that I published in 2008, which says that this shouldn't really happen. Of course, at the same time, the Navy was not calling for a massive scientific study. They were not calling on the government to investigate this issue. They merely are having a reporting change for their pilots. And, of course, the reports that their pilots will be filing, I assume, will remain secret. So it's a big change. It's not a change that yet can affect society as a whole, but it is surprising, and it's to the Navy's credit. And it's actually, you got to credit the fighter pilots who pushed this. I'm sure the Navy would not have changed a thing if the pilots had not put themselves on the line and said, look, there's something going on here. We're flying up there. We see it. Get your act together and give us some new rules. And that's what the Navy has done. But it's not just the U.S. Navy, of course. Several air forces worldwide, several in Latin America, have done the same thing. The French had done the same thing a few years ago. So it's not just the U.S. It's slowly happening elsewhere as well.
You use the videos and the Navy statements to make a very reasonable argument. You make that presentation in about less than 13 minutes. The reaction from the audience in the hall, I think it was recorded at Ohio State, it was very polite. It was enthusiastic, even. It seemed like people liked it.
Yeah, it was actually the audience for that talk were all high school students. We gave two talks that day, and there was a high school portion of the day, and then there was the grown-up portion. And that particular talk was in front of a bunch of high school students, so they made it more open than grown-ups. So actually, the second talk was more lively, and the grown-ups were more energized. I think the high school students were still a little bit stunned about the fact that I was talking at all about this. But it was kind of, both audiences, though, I thought were very appreciative, and I've gotten a lot of emails since then, almost all of it appreciative, just saying thank you, basically, is basically the main thing people say. I was very pleased with how it went overall. I mean, I was very nervous, and neither talk was that smooth, but I thought in terms of content, I got across the points that I wanted to make.
So that audience liked it, and the other audience liked it. And then there's a third audience, the TEDx people, who didn't have the same reaction. I don't know what the process is for how quickly a presentation like that gets put up. So share with me how it normally works, and then tell us how it worked for you.
Well, after the initial talk, which was November 15th, you know, we all asked, you know, when do these things get curated and put online? And I think we were told something like 4 weeks, 3 to 4 weeks or something like that. And after that time passed, nothing happened. All the videos were being held up, and we started to ask, well, when are they going to be put online? And we were told vaguely that there was some issue with one of the videos, but it wasn't my video, supposedly, that was the problem. But eventually it did, 4 months later, they finally did post the videos. And with mine, apparently there was some kind of internal debate about whether mine should be allowed to be put on online at all, because it supposedly violated the content guidelines. So they added that disclaimer at the last minute. And I believe that my people here, including Megan, had to argue, or somebody had to argue on my behalf, that my video should be allowed to go forward, is what I was led to believe, although I have no evidence of that directly, but it wouldn't surprise me. But the content violation flagging, I think, is classic, and I couldn't have hoped for better advertising in a way for the video. they really shot themselves. They basically proved my point in part by sticking that on there. So.
Exactly. It's exactly the point. It couldn't have proved it better. I mean, were you in effect hoping that they would do that?
It never occurred to me, actually, that would happen. It never occurred to me that my talk would be so problematic that they would actually even debate it going forward, because I didn't say anything in that talk that was anything except a simple statement of fact. I took no positions at all on anything, basically. And yet, nonetheless, people, I think, some people find this very difficult. But some people are fascinated by it. So there's a real range of opinion among adults as well as high school students. So it's very hard to predict. My colleagues who've seen it were at first nervous, but then once they saw the talk, they've all said, oh, yeah, no big deal. They all agreed with the argument. So,
anybody from higher up in the administration that Ohio State say, hey, call you on the carpet, or are we going to expect more of this? Or,
well, there was a brief, my department has like most departments, has a daily Twitter feed announcing all the accomplishments of our great faculty. And so when it came time to put my video on the Twitter feed, I guess apparently there was a discussion, and initially they said no. But then after I protested and they thought about it for a day or so, they went ahead and released it. I've received no comments at all from higher ups in the administration. I think their attitude, like many of my colleagues, is that this is a harmless, you know, hobby of one of our faculty members, and let's just hope it goes away. It's probably the attitude.
Well, I'm sure you're familiar with what happened with Dr. John Mack at Harvard.
Yes.
You know, he went way further out into the subject, into some really controversial areas than you have. But the idea that a tenured guy with his reputation, Pulitzer Prize winner even, would be grilled and face the possibility of having his tenure removed. Wow. Hopefully things have changed since then.
He was on much more thin ice than I was, because I had the Navy videos and I was sticking to what is kind of physically, scientifically observable and that kind of thing. And And he was talking about, you know, so-called alien abduction experience, and which is more subjective and less, seems less scientific. And so I think that he was, it was more easy to get him in trouble, in a sense, by his administrators than it would be in my case.
Is it easier for social scientists to take this on than physical science types? Because I know that it seemed like there was another video that was presented. I don't know if it's directly in response to you, but it popped up there almost as a rebuttal to you. And I didn't know if it's easier for social scientists like yourself, including political scientists, to go after that than the physical science guys.
Well, I haven't seen that video, so I should probably check it out. But my assumption is that it is easier for social scientists. I think in part for two reasons. One is that, well, first of all, I think that the whole issue of the UFO is a political problem before it's a scientific problem. You can't even get to the scientific problem until you get past the political problem of the taboo. So in that sense, you've got to have the social scientists in there first, kind of clearing the ground, or at least helping to clear the ground by exposing the taboo for what it is, showing how irrational it is and how reasonable, in fact, it would be to do some science on this topic like it would on anything else. I guess the other argument for why it's easier for social scientists, though, and this is several natural scientists, physical scientists, have told me this in emails over the past few weeks in response to my TED talk, a TEDx talk, that for them, they all live on grants. Their careers depend on their ability to get research grants from funding institutes. And if, you know, the people who give these grants get any wind at all that you as a scientist are interested in weird stuff like UFOs, there's a good chance you won't get the grants, your career will suffer, and then you may not get tenure and so on. Social scientists are much less dependent on grants. I get paid either way. And so in a sense, I don't have to worry about my career in the same way. I mean, I still have to worry about my reputation, but I don't have to worry about actually surviving in my career by losing all my funding and so on. So it is easier for social scientists in that way too. But I think fundamentally it's a political problem first anyway. So,
Well, we'd like to say thanks to Ohio State University for allowing you the freedom to pursue this and not coming down too hard on you. Good for you, OSU and TED Talks. I mean, the idea is, you know, a university like Ohio State, that should be where academic freedom support for it is strongest. TED Talks is supposed to be a platform where really leading cutting edge thinkers share their ideas with the world. If you're not going to have academic freedom there, I don't know where it can exist.
Yeah, no, I know it is. I mean, that is the being an academic is the best job in the world. At least it has been for me. And it's precisely because I have the freedom to make any argument I want, as long as it's a rational, reasonable argument. And by and large, my colleagues everywhere I've been have been very open-minded, and one-on-one, they're all perfectly happy to sort of be interested in or open to this UFO problem. But again, there's been no reaction in the field of social science anywhere, to my knowledge, to the arguments I made back in 2008, to my TEDx talk or anything. So again, it's silence has been the response. Not sort of enthusiasm, at least. But at least I'm not being trashed right and left, maybe behind my back, but not being trashed in public. So that's a start.
Well, we'll try to stir the pot for you and see if we can get somebody to trash you if you want. All right, we're talking with Dr. Alexander Wendt about UFOs seen through the prism of political science. We'll come back and talk about his idea, a model for what a UFO study could look like. Also get into a discussion about his nonprofit and some other research he's been doing, and then we'll open up the phone lines with your calls and questions and comments.